And without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Peter Saunders. And he's kindly going to give us about half an hour or so as a presentation, and there'll be a time for questions from the floor after that. So thank you very much, Peter.
Well, thanks very much, Marcus. It's lovely to be with you in this quite interesting place. I didn't quite know what to expect. But I originally come from New Zealand on the... You can't get much further away than that. And my wife and I, after we trained at medical school, I did surgery, she did pediatrics, and we went and worked with the Africa Inland Mission in Kenya in a mission hospital. And then we came on here at the end of the 1980s, just as the Berlin Wall was coming down and all those amazing changes were taking place. And we came to spend a year at All Nations Christian College, which is a missionary training college. It became 2 years, and then I had a big change of direction. I was called into student ministry, working with Christian Medical Fellowship, and I did that for 8 years, and I've been the CEO for the last 12. So having trained in surgery for the last 20 years, really, I've been using a different kind of scalpel in Christian ministry. And we live in St. Albans, just north of the M25, and we've got three kids and now pretty well settled in the UK. What I wanted to do with you tonight was... I've been asked to talk on medical ethics, and it's just such a huge area that we're not going to do much more than skim over the surface of it, but I want to try and give you the big picture of some of the things that are happening in this country and look at the way the principalities and powers are working, the way that the challenges that we've got to face as Christians. We're going to focus down on a couple of issues, and then we'll come to the more obvious Christian stuff at the end. So that's the kind of direction of travel that we're going to. But you'll see things will come up on the screen there, so it might be easier just to look up that way. CMF was set up in 1949. We're a fellowship of 4,000 doctors and 1,000 medical students throughout the UK and Ireland, and we're affiliated to about 70 other national groups around the world. And I'm also quite involved in public policy issues, so I'm the campaign director for a group called Care Not Killing, which brings together about 40 organisations which work together to stop a change in the law to allow euthanasia and to promote good care. So my work is partly leading the team of 25 or so and serving our members, and the other half of it really is working in public policy, trying to stop people doing bad things in this country, if you like. Now, what is medical ethics? Well, it's really about our obligations in the whole area of medicine, and it's incredibly broad in scope. So we've got issues at the beginning of life, like abortion, cloning, contraception, infertility treatments, that kind of stuff. And then there's issues at the end of life, euthanasia, assisted suicide, not-for-resuscitation decisions, advanced directives, that sort of thing. It covers issues of confidentiality and medical records, which is a hugely challenging area now with everything computerized, where people have access to very intimate details about you. Inter and interprofessional relations, because medicine and healthcare is now very complex, involving people with varied skills. Genes and consent. And there's a huge amount that we can now do with genetics. Yes, that is indeed a mouse with a human ear on its back, and we haven't got time to talk about how that's possible, but we all have the same genetic code. And consent and refusal, what can you do and what can't you do to patients? What do you need their requirement for consent for? What can you do when they're not able to give their consent? And then there's questions in a whole era of shrinking health budgets about how you use diminishing resources. Of course, it was a much bigger problem for us in Kenya than it is here, but now we are having to make, because we can do so much more, really difficult decisions about what we don't do. And then issues around treatment, prescribing and research. And I've just been talking to your pharmacist here about some of these issues. So, and then, of course, there's end-of-life issues as well. I mentioned some of those already, and it's all the stuff of popular films. Now, of course, that's the big picture of what ethics covers, but actually it has a personal face as well. And these are the sorts of issues that we all encounter in communities and in churches. The mother with a disabled baby and the decisions that she might be making about finding out what's wrong with her baby and what to do about it. Couples grappling with infertility, and infertility is incredibly common now. One in every seven couples in Britain will be infertile, and we'll have to make decisions about what they do about that. People with genetic diseases, about 8,000 different genetic diseases that you can pick up. Some of them guarantee that you get a particular disorder. Others of them just make it more likely that you might get breast cancer or bowel cancer or something else. Managing the terminally ill. The elderly relative with dementia. My dad died just 3 years ago from a very rapidly progressive dementia, and we're going to see something of a dementia time bomb in Britain as the population grows much more elderly. So we can look at the big picture, but also all of us at different times in our lives are going to encounter difficult decisions, and people working in healthcare, of course, are encountering them all of the time. And what's making medical ethical decision-making much more difficult is all these sorts of things. First of all, we can do much more, and so it raises the question, should we? We have gene therapy, we've got geriatrics, we have ventilators, we have treatments for all sorts of diseases now which were universally fatal even when I was at medical school not too long ago. So we can do a lot more. And then there's the whole issue about patient autonomy, patient free will, people wanting things. We've moved from an era of what we call doctor paternalism, doctor knows best, to a time when patients are increasingly want to take charge of their medical treatment. Media-fueled expectations, because, of course, we have the internet, that great agent Google, where you can find out about any disease and can get information which may be of very good quality but may be very poor. And so increasingly now people are doing their own research. We're practicing in an environment of economic restraint where budgets are being cut. And then probably the biggest challenge of all is that there's a loss of moral consensus. If you went a couple of hundred years ago when medicine was much more rudimentary in Britain, then most people pretty much thought the same, because people had grown up in a Christian culture where they'd imbibed values with their mother's milk, and they thought pretty much the same. But we now live in a multicultural, multi-faith society, and compounding that has been the rise in the Western world of secularism as well. So when we look at these issues, we look at them in a global sense, and we look at them as in the way they impact our own families, then as Christians we need to be thinking like the men of Issachar. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the book of First Chronicles. It's a wonderful book. Let me just plug it and say that the first 12 chapters, which are largely a list of names, are the key to the whole of the Old Testament, if you know it. But buried there in First Chronicles 12, you'll find this verse. It goes through and describes the various tribes in Israel and their characteristics. And we get to the men of Issachar, and it says that these men knew the times and knew what Israel should do. And isn't that a great challenge and a prayer for us as Christians in the 21st century? Do we understand the times in which we live, and do we know what we should be doing as God's people in those times? A few months ago, I had the privilege of going to the memorial service for John Stott in St. Paul's Cathedral. And he's one of these people I look back with huge gratitude to the way he's impacted my own life, the life of my family and friends through the books he wrote and through his preaching. And John Stott always talked about the importance of us being double listeners, people who listened to the word of God on one hand, and then we listened to the world of God on the other. And we were able in that double listening to bring the two together and apply one to the other. And Christians often fall into the trap of knowing the world and not the word, or knowing the word and not the world, and not bringing them together, living in a kind of schizophrenia. And what we've seen, I've been in the UK 20 years now, but the massive change, I think, in the last the last 5-10 years or so has been the rise of what we call the new atheism and the way it's impacting on our society. Now, the new atheism is, in a sense, no different from the old atheism. They believe that God doesn't exist, that death is the end, that you make morality up for yourself, and in fact that we're just clever monkeys living in a godless universe, the product of matter, chance, and time. That's the old atheism. It's as old as life itself. But the new atheism is different, not in its worldview and its convictions, but in the fact that it is actively proselytizing and much more anti-Christian. And so what we're seeing in Britain now is the rise, if you like, of new atheism with a militant secularism that goes with it. And that is hugely impacting in these sorts of areas. Now, in any generation, you'll find that the thinkers who introduce new ways of looking at the world publish their thoughts in the universities and the media and so on, and then it's in the next generation it's shouted in the streets. And the four horsemen of the apocalypse, self-called, are these gentlemen, Richard Dawkins, who I'm sure you've heard of, professor of the public understanding of science up in Oxford, but also Chris Hitchens, who recently died, Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, the faces of the new atheism, and many other people picking up the same worldview. I've listed the names of some of the more influential people. You might not have heard of many of them at all, but people coming from an atheist philosophy who have a profound degree of influence on the way that this country is going now. Some of them are MPs, some of them are philosophers, some of them are ethicists, some of them are heading up organizations. Now, if we look at Dawkins' critique of Christianity, it's very simple. The theory of evolution explains biological complexity, first of all, so you don't need a God. Now, of course, Christians have different views about how God actually created biological complexity, and we could talk about that all night. But the essence of atheism is that it's just the matter, our complexity. Human beings are just the product of matter, chance, and time. The Bible's unreliable. And more than that, the Christian God is not just irrelevant, but actually immoral. And you may have seen this quote. Who's read The God Delusion? One person, a few people have. Well, this, if you haven't read it, you may well have heard this quote. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Is that the God you know? No, I don't really recognize that either, but that is the way that Dawkins and his friends talk about it. And this, we've already sketched out, as the secular worldview. There's no creation. We're just the product of matter, chance, and time. Human beings are just higher animals. If there's any hope for us at all in the future, it's in terms of what science and technology can deliver, because there's no life after death. And we look for perhaps lengthened life and better lifestyles and better health through science and technology. But there's no new body. There's no resurrection. There's no new heaven and new earth. This is it. And when we look at secular values, and I'm just picking out a few key thinkers and influencers here, these may or may not be names that you've heard of, but Binding and Hock were a German philosopher and a lawyer back in the 1920s, and they wrote one of the most influential books in history called The Release of the Destruction of Human Life Devoid of Value. Very complex title, but in it they coined this term, life unworthy of life. The German word that describes it literally means human ballast, people who are lesser human beings, non-persons. And these guys in the 1920s really laid the intellectual framework for the Nazi Holocaust, which followed a couple of decades later. So you see, what gets whispered in ivory towers in one generation gets shouted in the streets in the next. Watson and Crick, you might recognised as being the discoverers of the molecular structure of DNA, which makes up our genes. But also, you might not be aware that both of them were advocates of infanticide. In other words, they believed that children in the first 3 days of life should have a number of tests, and if they didn't pass the test, then they should not be allowed to live. And more recently, we've had a number of very influential ethicists, philosophers who turned to medical ethics back in the 1970s and 80s and now pretty much dominate thinking in this whole area. And one of the most famous is a chap called Peter Singer, who was initially very interested in animal rights. He comes from Melbourne, Australia, now working in the US, but he wrote a very influential article back in the early 1980s in a pediatric journal called Quality of Life or Sanctity of Life. And basically what Singer said was that we need to get rid of this antiquated notion of the sanctity of life, the idea that human beings are made in the image of God and therefore greatly precious. He said we need to replace it with a new idea, the quality of life, that the life of every human being is actually determined by its capacity for rationality, communication, intelligence, and so on. And that human beings that don't have these qualities have a lower quality of life. Now, of course, if you take this point of view to its logical extension, as Singer does, then what that means is abortion on demand, infanticide, and euthanasia for people with dementia or who've lost their ability to contribute to human society in some way. And Singer actually termed coined the term speciesism to describe people who think that human beings are special and made in God's image. In other words, his conclusion was that an intelligent dolphin is worth much more than a human being with special needs, particularly one who doesn't have the same intellectual capacity as other people. So we have this evolution in thinking, which has worked its way out through medical ethical thinking and medical culture to give us the three secular virtues. Autonomy or free will says, I want it. Technology says, we can do it. And relativism says, well, why not if we want it and we can do it? And what we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years, particularly in Western culture, is that the fruit of secularism has been that in terms of knowing what's right or wrong, it comes down to personal choice and not revelation, because God doesn't exist. All the conversation now is around rights and not responsibilities, another big change. We talk about personhood, whether a human being has enough intellectual capacity to be a person or not, rather than the sanctity of all human life as being precious, made in God's image. And I'm involved in a number of debates at the moment with people who take the view, certainly on early human life, that human embryos and fetuses, unborn children, are not persons because they do not have the same mental capacity that you and I do. Reproduction becomes commodified and technologized rather than natural. And we see some of the fruits there at the bottom. And in a sense, what we have is two very different approaches to making decisions. One of them, which we call the secular or materialist approach, is that human beings are just one of many species and the value of human life depends on the quality it has, particularly its intellectual capacity, and that the weak should be sacrificed for the strong, that it's actually a good thing to be doing that. We should be concentrating on those who have more to offer. And you contrast that with the Christian or Hippocratic view, profoundly different, that all human beings are made in God's image, and that all human life is of infinite value. One of the most famous doctors in history in Britain was a chap called Sydenham, who practiced in London and in the 17th century. But he used to say to his medical students at the first lecture during the year, he outlined his own Christian faith and the way it impacted the way he practiced. And he said, the thing you have to realize is that human beings are hugely precious. And they're precious for two reasons. The first is because human beings are made in the image of God for a relationship with God, regardless of their age, their sex, their degree of deformity, their intellectual capacity, whatever. Every human being is made in the image of God. And he said the second reason that human beings are so precious is because God himself became a human being. And in so doing, gave nobility to the human race. And the Christian ethic, you could say, is summed up in Galatians 6:2. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. You see, it's not the weak sacrifice being sacrificed for the strong, but actually the strong making sacrifices for the weak, as Jesus himself did. While we were weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. The creator and sustainer of the whole universe became a man on a very insignificant planet in order to rescue us, and we're called to walk in his footsteps. So two very different approaches. Now, what we've seen in the UK over the last few years or so is the impact of this increasingly secular thinking about the nature of man and morality worked out in a whole series of different bills and laws that are going through. And in CMF, where, as I said, we do a lot of public policy work, what we've found, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years or so, there's been a huge growth of groups who are actively working to change the laws and change society in a very secular direction. And these are just some of them. Abortion Rights is a massively successful group. The British Pregnancy Advisory Service and Mary Stopes International, who do most of the abortions in Britain with your taxpayers' money. And then internationally, International Planned Parenthood Federation and UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, who are marketing abortion abroad. We'll come back to the scope of that fairly shortly. At the end of life, Dignity in Dying used to be called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. They changed their name just 6 years ago. But in the last few years, we've seen a proliferation of new groups. The Society for Old Age Rational Suicide, Friends at the End. Just 2 years ago, Health Professionals for Assisted Dying, working closely with Dignity in Dying. Exit International, run by an Australian called Philip Nitschke, who are marketing euthanasia internationally. And then, of course, the Dignitas facility in Zurich in Switzerland, where an increasing number of Brits are going abroad to end their lives, all working as the abortion groups are working to liberalise abortion laws, remove the need for two doctors, extend the law to Northern Ireland, bring in nurse abortion, home abortion, and so on. So these groups are working to legalise assisted suicide and euthanasia in Britain. Secular groups, the National Secular Society, British Humanist Association, you really didn't hear very much about them until recently, but they are very actively working in government, in the institutions, in the media, and so on, and very interested in issues like abortion, euthanasia, and so on. The Secular Medical Forum was set up to combat us, SMF, as opposed to CMF. We talked about the Dawkins and Co. already. And if you think of society as made up of a whole series of mountains, if you like, of influence, the church is one of those, but in all of the others, media, parliament and the judiciary, the medical institutions, art and entertainment, education and so on, all of these are the mountains of influence and culture, and all of them are increasingly dominated by a secular and atheistic mindset. Now, just to look at a few issues, to give you the big picture, abortion. Here's a stunning statistic for you. 100 million people die every year in the world. 58 million of them die from all causes apart from abortion. 42 million of them are unborn children dying from abortion. That's worldwide. In Britain, it's 200,000. Now, that's why abortion is a very important human rights issue, because there's no one more vulnerable, more innocent, and being killed in greater numbers unjustly than the unborn child worldwide. In fact, it's so common in many countries now that there's profound demographic change going on with falling birth rates and growing numbers of elderly people, and we're recognising now the spin-off problems as well for mothers, some of them listed there that we haven't got time to go into in detail. But what's happening in the UK at the moment? Well, there are 200,000 abortions a year. One in every four pregnancies ends in abortion in Britain. One in three women will have an abortion at some point. Very, very common. And what's particularly interesting is that 98%, so 196,000 of these, are done on mental health grounds, when there's actually no evidence that having an abortion helps your mental health relative to keeping the baby. So they're in effect technically illegal in Britain, but they still happen, and the judiciary and the police and so on turn a blind eye. What we're seeing though in the UK at the moment is that there's a change of attitudes taking place in society, I think largely because of the fact that people are saying this is just incredible that there are so many abortions taking place. So there are moves in Parliament at the moment to bring in independent counselling for women with unplanned pregnancies, which we will believe will cause many to change their minds. In fact, it's the experience of our own members working in general practice that about one in three women with an unplanned pregnancy will change their mind if you give them the time, the space, and the support necessary to be able to make a choice that's unpressured, because many women choose abortion because they feel they have no choice other than to do it. You might have seen the Telegraph newspapers recently being exposing malpractice, particularly abortion for sex selection reasons, which has had a lot of exposure. There are cases of doctors currently being investigated by the General Medical Council and the police. And there's a group which has been holding prayer vigils outside abortion clinics in the UK, which is causing a lot of people to think. Just quickly through these issues, infertility I mentioned, what's driving the huge number of infertile couples? And there are lots of causes of infertility. You've got to be careful to investigate every case, but what is really contributing to it is that women are waiting later to have children when they're less fertile and it's harder to get pregnant. Sexually transmitted infections are damaging women's tubes in particular, and there's a fall in babies available for adoption in Britain. Now, these three things have led to, in effect, a perfect storm of a need for artificial reproduction. And using techniques like IVF and GIFT and so on, there are now 4 million babies worldwide who are the results of IVF and other technologies. Of course, a lot of these are produced with donor eggs and sperm, where they have different biological parents and the parents bringing them up, which is generating all sorts of other challenges as well. And commercial surrogacy is a huge growth area where rich couples in the West are paying poor people in Indian villages and so on to carry children manufactured with eggs and sperm brought from abroad so that they don't have to go through pregnancy. It's a massive growth industry in Britain. Prenatal selection, another issue, because it's now possible to identify genetic disorders and other diseases or propensities in the womb or on embryos, it's much easier to find disabled individuals than to fix these disabilities. And so the whole direction this technology is going is towards the detection of babies with special needs, with various abnormalities in the womb or at embryo stage, and then simply not implanting them or going on to abortion. Huge problem. Down syndrome, that little girl has Down syndrome, three number 21 chromosomes. What we're seeing now in Britain is, on the one hand, more Down syndrome children being born because more women are leaving it until late to have pregnancies, where it's a bigger risk. but actually 98% of all Down syndrome children that are being detected before birth are being aborted in Britain because we don't value people who have special needs in this country. Euthanasia, end of life now, the arguments against, well, what does all that mean? Well, it means basically that if you look after people properly and you meet their, not just their physical needs, but their spiritual, social and psychological needs as well, then the overwhelming vast majority of people do not want to end their lives. This is Baroness Finlay, who's a professor in palliative medicine, and her mum, who died just a year or two ago. Mum wanted to die, but convincing her to live gave us both a gift beyond measure. And the things that happened in their relationship, look after people properly. If you legalize it, the danger is that you end up putting pressure on people to end their lives for fear of being a burden on relatives or on a society that's short of resources or on a health service or carers. Some countries and states have legalized it. In Oregon, assisted suicide's been legal since 1997. One third of people who have it do so for fear that they're being a burden upon relatives. One in six of them are depressed, and yet less than one in 20 have psychiatric evaluations. They rely on self-reporting so that we're not really sure entirely what's going on. We have about 20 people going to Dignitas from Britain every year. If we had an Oregon-type law here, we would have 1,000 a year. That would be the impact. Just across the North Sea, where this barge came from in the Netherlands, euthanasia has been legal since 2002, but it's been legally sanctioned before for much longer than that. If we had a Dutch-type law where both euthanasia and assisted suicide are legal, we'd have 13,000 British deaths a year. But there are people pushing for a change in the law. 8% of all deaths in the Netherlands now by what we call terminal sedation, which means basically that you give people a huge dose of sedatives and remove food and fluids, and they dehydrate to death. Dementia patients. Organs taken for transplant from euthanasia patients in Belgium is happening now. But one of the most challenging things is what we call the demographic time bomb. And on the left there, you've got, or at least on the right there, you've got the age structure of Nigeria, young people at the bottom, old people at the top. You can see it's very wide at the bottom, lots of young people coming through. On the left side is the United States. Britain would be very much the same, and you see it's pretty much even all the way up, and there are a huge number of older people. And that bulge in the war years is moving up. And that means that we're moving from a situation where in Western Europe we have three people working to every two dependent. In other words, younger than 18 or older than 60. And it's going to be one and one by 2060. Now, you add to that the shrinking budgets, the economic crisis, and so on and so forth. You've got something of a perfect storm. And when people say that the generation that killed its children through abortion will be ultimately killed by its children through euthanasia, there will be very strong forces driving this. And I've got a smile on my face, but, you know, I'm not joking about this. This is the direction that we are moving in Europe for the way that we've been living. And the economic forces are very powerful. 70% of elder abuse occurs in families, 12% of it is financial. Close to 50% of your total lifetime healthcare expenditure will be spent in the last 6 months of your life. And when we say it's £5,000 for chemotherapy for a week, £1,000 for good care, palliative care for cancer patients, but only £5 for a glass of barbiturate, the question rises, you know, do you really want to put that kind of temptation in front of health ministers? And this lady had cancer. She lived in Oregon, where assisted suicide is legal. She wanted chemotherapy. She was told she couldn't have it, but they could give her assisted suicide if she wanted it, said the Oregon Health Department. She hadn't asked for that, but that's the kind of thinking that you get when euthanasia and assisted suicide becomes just another treatment, which is actually far, far cheaper than other forms of treatment. She said no, she died naturally. Morally wrong, of course, and it's not just the Judeo-Christian tradition, but all these other codes of medical ethics as well. We've had three attempts to change the law in Britain since 2006, Joffe's Bill, Falconer's Amendment, McDonald's Bill in Scotland. All of them have failed. But this year, we're facing some massive challenges. Lord Falconer, who's pictured there, had a committee which he tried to... he rigged full of 12 people, most of whom agreed with him, to produce a report saying we should change the law to allow assisted suicide. It was largely very successfully criticised, but the pressure goes on. And this year we have two court cases which are coming up very shortly, which will be huge on the news, and there will be at least two new bills this year. There's one already started in Scotland to try and change the law. I have my bag, which is just under the screen there. One of the bags I've got has two huge files in it with all of the legal notes for these two court cases in which Care Not Killing will be intervening, because we think they're very, very dangerous indeed in terms of changing the law in a way that's going to put pressure on vulnerable people. I mentioned already the rise of secularism and the effect it's having on Christians in this society, and this was an inquiry by MPs who were Christians in the House of Commons earlier this year, and some members of the House of Lords joined them, and they did an inquiry called Clearing the Ground, in which they interviewed a whole lot of leaders of Christian organisations. I was one who gave oral and written evidence to the committee, but this was their conclusion. Christians in the UK face problems in living out their faith, and these problems have been mostly caused and exacerbated, in other words, made worse by social, cultural and legal changes over the past decade. And like in many areas of life, we're finding in Christian Medical Fellowship that our members are increasingly under pressure, and these are just five who in the last 2 or 3 years have run into problems with the establishment for their Christian faith. Richard Scott shared his faith with a patient in the surgery. There was a complaint from the patient's mother. He's up before the General Medical Council and may lose his license to practice. You might have seen him on the Big Questions on Sunday if you weren't here at church. Hans Christian Raab, a GP, who was sacked from a government committee on the misuse of drugs because he had written something about homosexuality expressing a biblical viewpoint about 10 years ago. Tammy Downs, another GP, who is very successful in a lot of women who come to her with unplanned pregnancies end up keeping their babies. They're all delighted. None of them's ever complained. But a fellow doctor did complain about her. She was up before the General Medical Council and on the front page of the Observer newspaper before they chucked the case out. And we're seeing a lot more of these vexatious complaints. Sheila Matthews, paediatrician, did lose her job in the Midlands because she didn't want to vote on gay adoption panels. Paul Miller's a psychiatrist who was approached by a patient who claimed to be Christian, wanting help with unwanted same-sex attraction. And this person turned out to be an undercover journalist working for The Independent, ended up on the front page, and he went through a year of grief with the General Medical Council, not knowing if he'd be able to carry on practicing and so on. So this is just the tip of the iceberg of the sort of things that you're reading about in the newspapers, and we're certainly seeing them. And most of these people have been in newspapers at various times. Now, I've run over a bit, but let me just close with the important bit, because we can't go through all these issues and talk about how we're going to approach every single one, and I'm just wanting to give you a flavour, but here's the approach. The first thing is that we really, as God's people, we need to have the mind of Christ. And that means thinking about the world in the way that God thinks about it, the way it really is, that human beings are image bearers. They're incredibly precious because they're made in God's image. Of course, we're masterpieces made by the master creator, but we're flawed masterpieces. We're sinners by nature, we're sinners by choice. We deserve nothing but judgment. And so we're incredibly precious, yet incredibly flawed, and in need of rescue. And of course, God does give us the gifts of science and technology, and he expects us to use them as good stewards and develop technologies that are going to help and serve human beings. But we also look to his wisdom, and we also look to our own redemption, because death is not the end. See, this is just the foretaste, and there's a new heaven and a new earth coming where we will have resurrection bodies like that of Christ after he rose from the dead. And so, unlike the atheists, I'm not looking to this life for perfect health, but I'm looking for the next one. A Christ-like mind, do we think about things like this? Christ-like obedience. We've talked about human dignity already. We regard human beings with respect, wonder, and need for their protection and empathy as their fellow sufferers, because human beings are made in the image of God. God gives us knowledge and science and expects us to use it, not in exploiting the planet and one another, but in caring for each other as he would care for us. We've talked about the sanctity of life, the basis of the sixth commandment, not taking innocent life. Why? Because it's precious and made in God's image. Marital purity, one man, one woman for life, under threat in the UK as well. Children, as a gift, arrows in the quiver, olive shoots around the table that the Psalms talk about. Confidentiality, the importance of using information about people to serve them and for their good rather than to exploit them. Justice, equity, and ends and means, that the end does not justify the means, that we've got to do God's work, God's way. Some of the principles. Christ-like obedience. But then, of course, it's not just having the mind of Christ, knowing what's right and wrong, having the wisdom to do that. But in order to act right, we also need to be transformed human beings with a Christ-like character, imitators of God, having his character of love and compassion, having the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control being worked out in our lives. And then finally, Christ-like cross-bearing. What do I mean by that? Well, of course, the cross was our means of salvation. This is my favorite picture of the crucifixion, St. John of the Cross by Salvador Dali. I love it because of the muscular Christ who is not self-absorbed but looking down on the world, and he's there by his own choice and free will in order to rescue us. And the cross, of course, is our means of salvation, but we're also called to walk in the pathway of the cross, to carry the cross in our lives, to be like Christ. And I think that works itself out in a couple of ways. Firstly, that we're willing to suffer to care for people, because it's costly in terms of time and money to do it properly. And secondly, that we are willing to suffer in standing up for Christian values in a world that's increasingly hostile to them in the face of persecution. Now, John 8, 1-11, of course, is the story of the woman caught in adultery, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with. And you know, Jesus was there and he was asked, what do we do? This woman was caught in the act of adultery. What should we do? And, of course, although she was caught in the act, so there must have been a man there. The man, interestingly, wasn't there being stoned to death. He was somehow let off, and he could see their hypocrisy. And, of course, he said, let whoever's without sin cast the first stone. Of course, he was the only person there who could have thrown it. No one else was able to, and they all walked away. And then, of course, Jesus not only forgave her, but then went to the cross to die to pay the price for her sin, as he did for all of our sin. And, you know, I love that story because I think it's a story of an ethical dilemma. You see, in order to obey the law, Jesus should have thrown the stone. But in order to, you know, that was one choice, to kill her. Another choice was just to, you know, to let her off and let injustice reign and say, well, you know, sin's not important. But he could have taken any one of those choices, but he chose the third way, which was going to the cross to pay the price for her sin, the costly, painful way of obedience and redemption. And I think often in medical ethical decisions, and I've been in many situations where you seem to be caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, either this patient dies in terrible pain, or we give them a lethal injection. Either we have an abortion, or this woman has to look after a child that she's not capable of looking after. You know, we've got these terrible dilemmas. And just as Jesus found the third way of going to the cross for this woman, there's always a third way for us. Now, with end-of-life issues, the third way is called good palliative care in the hospice movement, but it takes a lot of good training and time and money and expense to be able to do it. For abortion, there is a third way: good antenatal care, support, adoption possibly, helping people through to make the right decisions. And of course, we've got the responsibility to pass things on to the next generation as well. I've overstepped my time markers. I don't know whether we've got any time for questions, but I'm very happy to take some. And I'm sorry that it's a very rapid look through